Schools, pediatricians, and some local health agencies are all getting ready for a new wave of COVID-19 vaccinations, with final approval for shots for children as young as 5 expected from the CDC next week. That's just one of the topics we'll discuss as we review the week's news on And Another Thing. I'm Derek Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. Also ahead, an apology from the Chancellor of UMass Amherst about his response to racist emails. How is Massachusetts going to spend its federal COVID relief funds? And with the final days of campaigning ahead, our panelists will dive into next week's municipal elections.
Joining us today to review the week's news are Larry Parnas, investigations editor for the Berkshire Eagle. Welcome back, Larry. Mike Dobbs, the executive editor of Reminder Publication. Thanks for being here again, Mike. And reporter for The Republican and Mass Live, as well as an editor for El Pueblo Latino, Elizabeth Roman. Welcome back to all of you. Thanks for being here on And Another Things Week in Review.
Let's begin with COVID-19. This week, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education in Massachusetts announced that most K through 12 students will be required to wear masks in school into the new year. The earliest the mask requirement could be lifted is the middle of January. But while masks must remain on at schools, some local mask mandates are coming to an end. Springfield's indoor mask requirement ends on Monday, and it's already been lifted in West Springfield. Director of Public Health Jean Galloway says the health board is encouraged by declining COVID infections.
Having made it through the biggie and with numbers not drastically increasing and continue to decline in our region, they just felt that it was at a point where they could reduce mask wearing.
So for the panel, we've got masks still on in schools, masks slowly coming off in public. What do you think the public is going to make of these different messages regarding COVID-19 at the moment? Elizabeth, do you want to start?
Sure. I think with schools, it's a very different situation. You still have a large portion of that population that cannot be vaccinated, and therefore they're at a higher risk than adults or even kids at the high school level who can be. I mean, in Springfield, we're looking at 51% vaccination rate in the city as a whole. So we still have a long way to go anyway, to get there. And on top of that, you're in a school building. You're I know in the urban schools, you can't do the 6 feet social distancing. There's no space for that. So you've got kids that are 2-3 feet apart, sitting together, talking to each other for group projects and interacting as kids do, wanting to touch each other and hug and, roughhouse. That's just how kids are. So I think it's a smart tactic to wait until they reach that 80%, according to Desi's recommendation before they remove them. Plus, kids are adaptable. I mean, they're used to wearing the masks. As long as I think the mask breaks are responsible and consistent throughout the day, I think they can handle it.
There's so many wrinkles to this. And boy, let's just say that this year is not the normal school year that people thought this might be. It's crazy. I think on the masking, one interesting aspect to this is even the districts that have older students, say high schools, that reach that 80% vaccination level, some of them, including Monument Mountain High School, regional high school in the Berkshires, they've decided not to ask the state to allow them to remove masks because they don't want to have to enforce mask use among the one-fifth that still aren't in that group. So, that's another way that this is being threaded. And I think I would chalk it all up into this wacky year continues.
And we should specify schools have to reach an 80% vaccination rate before they can then request to have their mask mandate lifted. Mike, we've got masks coming off in some places, masks staying on in other places, and we're not just talking schools and in public, also between different municipalities. Some lifted their mask mandates long ago, some still have them. Do we think that this is creating more confusion around the COVID-19 messaging?
Well, yes, there's a lack of consistency, but that's understandable in terms of the way the mask mandates have been set up. That is for schools or for government buildings or for businesses. Now, for example, I just was at the MGM press event announcing they've reopened the poker room. So I said, what are you going to do about masks? Well, visitors to MGM no longer after November 1st have to wear masks because the city of Springfield will have eased its mask mandate, but their employees are going to be wearing masks. So that's just one example of sort of a mixed message. the smart thing is to keep a mask in your pocket, because you may be going into a building or a business that still does require it.
Public health officials in all of New England states are getting ready to administer the first COVID-19 vaccinations for children between the ages of 5 and 11. With final federal approval widely expected, those vaccinations could begin as early as next week. Health officials in all states have had several weeks to prepare. Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont says he expects 100,000 doses for his state.
Everything with parental permission. We've got to be really careful about this. You have to bring people along. You just can't jam it.
So the question is, with all of the anticipation, so much confusing news, does it appear that everything is on track for this to go smoothly? Larry, you laugh.
Well, I think it's going to go better than it did in the spring because there's a supply. I mean, so much of the anxiety in the spring was whether or not you could actually obtain a vaccine dosage. And I think in this case, for the 5 to 11-year-olds, it's really going to be what will predict the family adherence or compliance with this is going to be what the parents did. And Massachusetts is doing fairly well in terms of vaccination, not as well as they'd hoped, still hasn't cracked 70% yet. So I think the parents are going to, if they vaccinated themselves, I think they're going to get their kids in to the doctor's offices and pharmacies.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with Larry. I think it will be very dependent on parent decision. Obviously, while the state is doing fine, I always have to bring back Camden County has low numbers, particularly the urban areas. And so you're going to see that be an issue. I mean, Springfield has struggled very much to get up to this 51. It's a big deal for us to even be halfway vaccinated. So do I think it will go smoothly? No, these things never do. I mean, it's such a new situation that we're in, the pandemic in general.
We are seeing that some adults still don't want to get the vaccination. So the question is, will parents that are hesitant to get the vaccination themselves then present their children to be vaccinated, Mike?
That's an excellent question. Vaccinations are still an incredible hot button topic. And you still even have elected officials locally who are dancing around it. I asked a group of city council candidates last night from the city of Springfield about if they would support a vaccination mandate for city employees. And two of them said no, they wouldn't, and a couple others tried their best to dance around it. Something that fascinates a 67-year-old like me, I really didn't have an option as a kid not to get polio vaccine, not to get the smallpox vaccine. So I am hoping that parents will reconsider their points of view, if not for themselves, at least for their children.
This is our Friday Week in Review on And Another Thing from New England Public Media. Still to come, an apology from the Chancellor of UMass Amherst over his response to racial tensions on campus and why some essential workers in Massachusetts could be getting some bonus pay. Stay with us.
This is And Another Thing. On Fridays, we look back and analyze some of the news of the past week. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Derek Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. Our panelists today are Republican and MassLive reporter Elizabeth Roman, Berkshire Eagle Investigations editor Larry Parnas, and Reminder Publications executive editor Mike Dobbs.
It has been a very rough 3 weeks for the University of UMass Amherst. A shelter in place was issued at the university last Tuesday because there was a hostile and armed person around the campus, and so they went into lockdown. UMass Amherst also saw its fourth racial incident in 2 months after a series of emails, racist emails, were sent to African-American groups on campus back on September 24th. As of yesterday, October 28th, Chancellor Kumbo Sumusabi apologizes for not having more of a visible and forceful response to those racist emails. The university has hired an outside cybersecurity firm to investigate these emails. Lots of questions here. The first one is, why do you think it took so long for the chancellor to respond to these racist emails and to the African-American groups on campus?
I hope that it's not because they don't think there's anything they can do about it, but I think that that could be what's kind of underpinning this. UMass has a very fraught history of racial division and racial animosity. This kind of thing happened last year on social media. And now, after this long delay, 3 weeks after this Student Government Association condemned these emails, the chancellor is saying, we want to learn how to create a more supportive, just, and equitable community. And I think they don't need an advisory commission to get that answer. It's you arrest and charge people who engage in this kind of thing, and you encourage reporting of racist acts by taking them seriously.
Elizabeth, the question is the answer just announcing the formation of a Black Advisory Council? Is that the answer?
No, of course not. I mean, I think we've talked about this, you know, for so long now, ever since George Floyd, I mean, many years before that, but this idea of like performative allyship and saying that you're going to do something and you create a committee just so that you can save face, but nothing really changes. I mean, it goes down to the root of the issue. I went to UMass in the early 2000s. There were no people of color in my classes, and that's not the idea that I was sold when I went there. I thought that it was going to be, you know, a state school, a diverse environment, and that was not the case. How about you just make your, you know, teaching staff and your student staff more diverse, and then you have an opportunity for people of different cultures to come together and, you know, diplomatically solve their issues. But if you have a predominantly white institution, which is the case in many campuses across the country, then these issues are going to keep arising.
Michael, Chancellor Subbaswamy is a minority himself. He's the top of leadership. Why does this keep happening on their campus?
Because UMass is a microcosm of American society. I don't have to tell anybody about the nature of racial strife in this country and racial injustice. And as a proud 1976 graduate of the university, I can tell you that there was racial issues in the mid-70s, and it's sad that there are still racial issues now in 2021. The chancellor has got to be the leader. The chancellor has got to be a person who responds immediately to this kind of situation. Whoever is in that position, he or she cannot wait a moment without trying to take some sort of action to correct these things.
Attorney Ben Crump, who is the civil rights attorney, has now become involved with this case. It is possible that there could be some legal action taken against UMass Amherst by the National NAACP. Larry, how would that play out for UMass's reputation?
I'm not sure I could say, but all of these kinds of consequences are the fruit of the school's inaction and failure to get up and over this. I think Elizabeth made a very good point about diversity. And Mike, you're noting that, you know, decades later, this is a school that still cannot shed this problem. You know, in a similar way that Boston, for all of its progressive politics, still has a tradition of racial injustice that it can't quite shed. I would think that further oversight and involvement with groups that press this will help the university, whether it likes it or not.
Turning now to some wider statewide matters. For the past 5 months, the state of Massachusetts has been sitting on some $5.3 billion in unrestricted federal COVID-19 relief funding. Now, legislative leaders have issued a plan for using at least some of that money. They're proposing more than $3.5 billion be put into relief efforts for homeowners, small businesses, schools, and for infrastructure repair. But the biggest expense would be bonus payments to low-income essential workers who were not able to remain home at the height of the pandemic. Here's Massachusetts House Speaker Ron Mariano.
We wanted it to benefit the folks who stayed at their posts through the whole pandemic, the folks that worked in the nursing homes, that drove the buses, that worked in the supermarkets, that were out there every day servicing the economy, yet everything else around them was closing.
Payments for workers that qualify would be between $500 and $2,000. Speaker Mariano has also said he doesn't want this program to be, quote, overly generous. So for the panel, the state government has surplus dollars right now. That $500 million price tag on these bonuses for essential workers, is that too expensive? Mike, what are your thoughts?
No, I don't think it's too expensive. This whole concept is that this money is supposed to be used to help people get back on their feet. Whether you're a small business person or you're an individual who has gone through some real financial issues due to the pandemic, It's a sad thing to have people talk about, well, we can't be too generous. This is literally once in a generation, maybe once in several generations, opportunity to try to use this money to actually make some long-term improvements to the lot of people living in the Commonwealth, and especially people who have really suffered through this pandemic.
Elizabeth, same question. These are probably one-time bonuses that these people will be getting. Do you think that's enough?
I mean, $500 to $2,000, how could anyone say that that is a generous sum of money? You're talking about over a year of people not being able to have a full salary or any salary at all. An apartment in Springfield is $1,400 a month. I mean, give me a break. I think it's a start. I think it's, you know, it's important to acknowledge that all of these people did work during this really strenuous, scary time. And yeah, healthcare workers for sure, but, you know, grocery store workers, the guys who picked up our trash every week.
Larry, yes.
Well, I just would note that one of the allocations that would go for economic development earmarks $200 million for tax relief for small businesses. But it's really to cover the tax that they had to pay on their prior relief infusions. So if the state can do that for private business to help push back their tax liability, this is a very small gesture, really, for essential workers who kept working.
Municipal elections are scheduled in many Massachusetts communities next Tuesday, Election Day. That means one more hectic weekend of campaigning. In North Adams, which will elect its first woman mayor, here's voter Raymond Felix on what's important to him at the polls.
There's a lot of art here, but it's not really bringing, you know, jobs here. That's what the economy here needs, jobs, more jobs.
North Adams is just one of few communities where there will be a new mayor in Western Mass. Since the incumbents are not running again, the others are Holyoke and Northampton. Elizabeth, I know you are watching a few races that are going on as well. Which ones are standing out to you?
Yeah, I'm actually very interested in the Northampton race. You have Dave Narkowitz, who's decided not to run again after being there since 2011. That's a long time in mayoral office. You've got Gina Sciarra and Mark Warner going against each other. Historically, Northampton has voted for the insider. So she is on the city council. She's, I believe, president of the city council. Warner is a local businessman, but I think female mayor, they've had one before. Claire Higgins was you know, beloved in the area. So I think it'll be interesting to watch and see if tradition sticks in Northampton.
Larry, we turn to you now for North Adams.
Yes, that sounded like a pretty unhappy North Adams prospective voter. I wonder if he came out during the preliminary election when only 16% of the registered voters did. This will be North Adams's first time electing a woman as mayor. And in some ways, they share many points of view. They are interested in economic development. They both think the city should get a new police station. But one of them, Jennifer Maxey, is not willing to support a Proposition 2.5 override for that. And that's been really what has held back action on getting a new police station. Lynette Bond is currently an administrator at the MCLA, the local state college in North Adams. In a funny way, this is a race that is reminiscent of earlier contests between camps. And Jennifer Maxey, though she says she's her own woman, is thought to be the standard bearer for John Barrett, the longtime former mayor. And Lynette Bond is more aligned with Richard Alkenbright, who was recently a mayor before Tom Bernard, who's opted not to run. It's an interesting race. It could be close. Maxey had more votes in the preliminary and could well be the victor.
Michael, are people coming out to vote in these municipal elections? Are the numbers going to be there that we expect to see on a larger level?
Well, you know, the rule of thumb is that generally to get large turnout, you need at least a mayor's race. You know, in Springfield, we have a school committee and city council race, and the expectation is that the voter turnout is going to be quite low. However, in Holyoke and Westfield, because those are very contested races, the hope is that that's going to turn people out. You have a very close race in Westfield with Mayor Don Humison and former police captain Michael McCabe, who, by the way, ran against each other 2 years ago. So we have basically a classic rematch of these two candidates. In Holyoke, you've got Mr. Garcia and Mr. Sullivan going after each other. Now, that one to me is very interesting because this is a classic old Holyoke versus new Holyoke kind of race. Garcia is much more progressive. He comes to Holyoke with the experience of being a town manager in Blandford, and by the way, turning around a very troubled town of Blandford government. Sullivan is a city councilor and a former businessman. That one has been a little bit prickly and a little bit rough. It's going to be very interesting to see who actually comes out of that race as mayor. But I suspect that the only communities that you're going to see a halfway decent turnout are going to be the ones with mayoral races. We also have a mayor's race in East Hampton, which has been pretty interesting. So Northampton, East Hampton, Westfield, and Holyoke down here in this neck of the woods are, of course, the races that we're all watching.
This is to the panel, lastly on this. Out of the candidates you've all mentioned in the communities, who is garnering the most attention from the Latino voter?
In Holyoke, we have a Latinx candidate, and I believe that he is getting a great deal of support. Having said that, there are also Latinx who have come out for Michael Sullivan. So at least in Holyoke, you know, when you have a candidate, you're assuming that members of that candidate's ethnic group is going to support him. And we're going to have to see that come next Tuesday.
In Springfield, you have a school committee race between Peter Murphy, who's been there quite a long time, versus Ayanna Crawford, a Black candidate. You know, Latinx voters don't always just vote Latinx. They sometimes vote for other people of color. They sometimes vote for, you know, white candidates if they feel that they're the ones that are representing their interests best. So definitely the person's ethnic background doesn't necessarily mean that they will garner more votes. But I do think that if it's someone that comes from the same neighborhood and the same values, that makes a difference. So I am particularly interested in that race. I think it'll be fun to see what happens. They're both very qualified candidates. So yeah, I think it just depends on who aligns with the things that you want for your city or your town.
This has been And Another Things Week in Review. Our panelists this week were Reminder Publications executive editor Mike Dobbs, Elizabeth Roman, reporter for Mass Live and The Republican, as well as an editor for El Pueblo Latino, and investigations editor for the Berkshire Eagle, Larry Parnas. Thanks again to all of you. I'm Maya Schwader.
I'm Derek Kennedy. And Another Thing returns next week. Catch up on any episodes by visiting our webpage at nepm.org. And Another Thing is an ongoing conversation. Share your thoughts across social media, Twitter, and Facebook. Our handle is @AAT on NEPM. We look forward to talking with you next week.